The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. Round one tries to test their vocabularies. Two marks if they get the meaning of these words roughly right. Beginning with Dillis Powell. Dillis, what is a primogenitor? P-R-I-M-O-G-E-N-I-T-O-R. Primogenitor.
It's a first something or other.
Yes.
Ancestor.
Yep, that's good enough. Your earliest ancestor, or it could be rather more loosely, any ancestor that you happen to have sort of knocking around. Two marks. Dennis Norden, what is a vermicide? V-E-R-M-I-C-I-D-E, vermicide.
Well, vermicide. Icide means killing.
Yes.
Trying to do with death. Verm. Killing verm. Verm, verm. I think it could be that, if you have gin and vermouth, and somebody says, don't put too much vermouth in, because you'll kill it. Well, that way of destroying a drink is called vermicide. Or it could be killing vermin.
A particular kind of vermin, Dennis?
I have no doubt of that, Jack. All much too easy up to there.
Worms.
Yes.
Worms.
You worm.
Worms.
Yes. That's absolutely right. Vermicide is a worm killer. Not the chap who does it, but the drug by which he carries it out. Two marks. Anne Scott James, what is a sen? S-E-N.
Sounds Eastern.
Yes.
It's Chinese.
Not Chinese, but near enough.
Yes. Well, near enough, as you say. A Far Eastern coin, I think.
Yes, that'll do. All right, not China, but which?
Japan.
Yes.
I've been there.
All right.
So little money when I was there. Didn't click.
A sen is a Japanese coin, and just for your personal information, Anne, it's a hundredth part of a yen.
I had so much money, I didn't notice stuff like that.
Much money, but little sins.
All right, Frank, it's your turn. Frank Muir, what is the meaning of parbuckle? P-A-R-B-U-C-K-L-E. Parbuckle.
Parbuckle? A few weeks ago, I did a story on this very same program about the man who invented the holes in people's belts. So the answer to the question, for whom the belt holds, is carbuckle. It's also actually it's another name for Spanish windlass.
Yes.
Which is a device whereby you haul things up cliffs, round things,
yes,
by lowering ropes, running the ropes round objects, and then hauling them up. It's a kind of curious block and tackle principle of physics.
That'll do, Frank. Well done. Two marks. Well, before we start round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and I want the two women members of the team to study their quotations, because at the end of the program I shall ask them where those quotations come from. Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, your quotation is your journey really necessary? And Anne Scott James and Dennis, your quotation is, a little touch of Harry in the night. And at the end of the program, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. And so on to round two, which is about legends and mythology. Two marks if you get a right answer. Dennis Powell, who killed the Gorgon Medusa?
Zola.
Perseus.
Yes, and do you remember what sort of help he had in doing it?
Oh, Athena helped him.
Yes.
And gave him a
book token.
He gave him a helmet which made him invisible.
Yes, quite right.
I think
that'll do. Two marks. Perseus was given by Athene, who was a friend of his, Only a good friend. Winged sandals so he could fly, a magic bag in which he could put the Gorgon's head, Medusa's head, when he killed her, and this helmet of Pluto, which made him invisible, and so he managed to kill her. Otherwise, he'd have been turned into stone. Dennis Norton, who was Psyche?
When I was 12, I used to always read that word as peach. She was part of the well-known double act of Cupid and Psyche.
Yes.
They were also friends. But they were on such good terms that... Now, wait a minute. He said that he would be her friend, providing she never looked at him.
Yes.
And she never looked at him, except for one night, when he was asleep, she lifted up a lamp and looked at him, and dropped hot oil all over his shoulder.
Yeah.
That time. Yeah. As they should do to every one of these Greek gods more often. And they weren't friends anymore after that.
That's the most masterly shortened version of the story of Cupid and Psyche by Apuleius and the Golden Ass that I've ever yet heard. Well done, Dennis. Anne Scott-James, what was the phoenix?
Well, the phoenix is one of those mixed up... it was a bird which rose from the ashes.
Yeah, and in which country?
Renewed itself.
Egypt, I think.
Yes, absolutely right. That's all right, that'll do. The phoenix was the fabulous sacred bird of Egypt, which came to Heliopolis, the city, every 500 years, when its father was about to die. There was never more than one phoenix at a time, which distinguishes it from most other birds, but each time it perished in the fire, a fresh-born phoenix arose from the ashes. Frank Miller, what was the palladium or palladium?
It was it's a metal, for one thing. It's a rather rare metal.
Yes.
Palladian is a type of architecture around the villas of Venice.
This is mythology rather than architecture.
It's something to do with Athena.
Yes.
Pallas Athene.
Yes.
It was something which she used, or was her breastplate. Or something of the sort.
Well, it might have been. Yeah,
one.
Well, it might have been. Then that's good enough.
One of the pair, I would have presumed.
Yes, you're thrashing about rather desperately in Greek mythology, and I'll give you half a mark.
I'm not. I'm standing back here aloofly.
was it a kind of something of nothing to do with a thunderbolt?
No. It was an old carved image. Either of Athene herself or of a girl called Pallas, whom Athene unfortunately had killed by mistake. And it was preserved as a legendary image at Troy because they thought that once it was taken away from Troy, Troy would fall. And therefore it was stolen during the Trojan War by Diomedes with the help of Odysseus. And after that, a good deal later, several books later, in fact, Troy did fall. Well, now around about rather curious expressions which came into use during the last World War or were imported round about that time from America. Two marks if you get them right. Beginning with Dillis Powell, your word is southpaw. Southpaw.
It means a left-handed boxer or cricketer or something. Anyhow, it's left-handed.
Yes, or rabbit.
Or rabbit. It's a left-hander.
Yeah, I think that'll do. Do you remember the game it originally came from?
Baseball.
Yes, well done, Dillis. Jolly good. Two marks it is. Dennis Norton, snazzy, S-N-A-Z-Z-Y.
Well, it means sort of very smart with it.
Yes. I don't know what it comes from the least, but you're dead right. You'll get your two marks. Snazzy is in the fashion or with it. Anne Scott-James, to tickle the ivories.
Tickle the ivories means to play the piano.
Yes. Absolutely right. Two marks. It means to play the piano. Frank Muir, in a pig's whisper.
In a pig's whisper? Presumably it means gently.
No.
Softly. Slowly.
No.
Or
loudly.
No, he's getting there.
Quickly.
Yes. Stick to that one, Frank.
Quickly? You're going back a bit. This isn't contemporary slang.
No, it isn't. I think that's good enough, because you've spotted two things about it. First of all, it means very quickly or immediately the time a rather small pig takes to make a rather small grunt, I think is the idea. It is a bit of American slang, but Frank was right in saying it goes back much further. It comes in Pickwick Papers of Dickens. You will find yourself in bed in something less than a pig's whisper, which is said by a friend of Bob Sawyer's to Mr. Pickwick. 2 marks. On our round of origins and derivations, 3 marks is the maximum. If members of the team can define both what the phrase means now and then give me the origin and derivation of it, how it originated. Dearest Paul, to make no bones about it.
Not to make a fuss about it, to do it readily and willingly.
Yes.
Make no bones about it. Make no bones about it.
Originally?
Playing with the bones outside pubs, in the street, or whatever it was.
No, that isn't right.
There's a game you play with bones.
Yes, what are bones?
Bones? What are bones? Kind of dice.
Yes. Difficult. I don't believe this is the right explanation, but I'll give you one
well,
and
give
a half
it.
Out of three. you're quite right in saying what the present meaning is, that doing or saying or accepting something without hesitation. But the most probable explanation is that it wasn't quite exactly the same phrase, but to find no bones in it, which meant that you could swallow it without difficulty. Dennis Norden, to have a nightcap.
He's a last drink before turning in, old
yes.
chap.
And originally?
Originally, now, why should a nightcap be a drink? Well, I'll tell you why. It was before there was electricity.
Yes.
And if you wanted to take a drink up to bed, and you had to carry these great candelabra, you had a candelabra in each hand. The only way you could carry the drink was put it on your head. So from then on, a drink was last drink at night was known as a nightcap.
Now,
there is doubtless some other explanation put forward for this.
Not being quite literal enough, Dennis.
Well, they didn't wear it all
night.
Yes, a nightcap kept you warm in bed.
Yes, you're home and dry, I think. It now means, of course, having a last drink before going to bed. And it comes from the days when people did wear nightcaps. And it was thought that you slept better if you wore a nightcap. Particularly in the days when people wore wigs in the daytime and their heads were shaven and therefore got jolly cold in bed at night. And from that, the phrase grew so that, first of all, wearing a real nightcap ensured a good night's sleep and very much pleasanter. Yet the modern idea is that if you have a good stiff drink, you'll sleep better, too. Now, Anne Scott-James, the lotus eaters.
Well, I didn't use the phrase now. Well, lotus eaters now means somebody who's just idle and idles away the time.
It's not entirely only idle.
Well, lazy and sleepy, as I would have thought.
Most of that.
Well, let's go back.
It comes from the
lotus eaters of the Odyssey.
Yes.
Who simply slept and dawdled their life away and were very foolish and very lazy.
But they ate.
They ate the leaves, the flowers of the lotus. The leaves of the lotus.
Yes. Nowadays, people will devote themselves both to idleness and luxury and don't bother about the world as it whirls round them. Sort of ostriches, very rich ostriches with their heads permanent in the sand. And in the Odyssey, as Anne quite rightly says, they lived on this island where they ate the lotus plant and forgot their friends and their homes and all desire to come back to their native land. Odysseus had a frightful job getting them away from there. 3 marks. Frank Muir, parasite.
A parasite is somebody who lives upon the endeavours of somebody else.
Yes.
And a bloodsucker, somebody who has no kind of aptitude himself and exists by using other people's.
And originally?
Well, it's a word for insects, isn't it? That have parasitic habits.
Yeah.
Like fleas have littler fleas to bite them and so on, ad infinitum.
Yes, I think that'll do. 3 marks it is. Nowadays, a sponger or hanger-on who flatters other people to get a living at their expense, and also, of course, botanically or zoologically, an insect or plant which has all similar habits. It comes from two Greek words meaning eating alongside somebody else's food, roughly, eating at another's table. And from this, it not only was used to describe parasitic plants and insects, but also human parasites, and judging from Greek literature, there are a fair number of those about. Three marks. Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier on the programme. For two marks, Lillis Powell, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Is your journey really necessary?
It was a poster during the last war.
Who for and about?
About the British Railways.
Yes, I don't think it was called British Railways then, but it was a railway poster in the war years, 1939 to 45, trying to save travelling time and space. Two marks. Now, Anne Scott-James, the origin of your quotation, and if you remember, this was a little touch of Harry in the night.
Well, it's not a musical song. I think it's Shakespeare.
Yes.
Henry the Fifth.
Yes, quite right. And at what point do you remember of the play?
Well, I think just before Agincourt.
Yes, absolutely right. Two marks. Well, now I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So, first of all, back to Frank Muir. Is your journey really necessary?
Is your journey really necessary? The Errant Heart, a romantic novel by Francesca Muir, Limited. I say, goody, goody, gumdrops, what a frabjous day, cried Sarah Chichester Chumley, leaping from her bath, going over to her cottage windows and drawing the curtains. The fact that she did these two actions in that order was known by every male within 7 miles of the district, because she was a lovely girl, Sarah, a lovely, lovely girl. She thought, I'm going to see Johnny today. Nice, nice Johnny. Rapidly she dressed. She put on just a casual silk blouse, a bikini bottom, and her army boots. Her army boots were a protest. Well, Sarah Chichester Chumley's protest against her father, who was Lord Lieutenant Governor of the county. And this aristocracy who her parents, because her mother, before she married, was, of course, single. And she wanted to protest against the whole thing of these men having wars every so many years, and why don't they stop it? It's all so silly and wasteful. And her father, before he became Lord Lieutenant Governor of the county, was Major in the Grenadier Guards Corps of Regiments. And she wanted to protest against that. And that's why she left the Sloane Square set. And she'd gone away and spent £17,400 of Daddy's money on this broken-down cottage in the woods. Tra-la, 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 and sing nice, nice Johnny today, she carolled. Nice, sweet Johnny, medical orderly at the cottage hospital. Nice, kind Johnny, shy, just occasionally smiling at her and bringing her little things home from his work. Just a bandage, perhaps, or once when he was in the path lab, a foot. It was so helpful, the cottage was so drafty, and the doors did so bang, and the foot did keep them shut. But funnily enough, as she walked towards Johnny, her footsteps took her past the cottage where Tarquin Jellyneck was in residence. Tarquin Jellyneck, quite unlike Johnny. 7'9", he was, of manhood. An actor. She felt her steps dragging towards the cottage, just for a glimpse of Tarquin. And then suddenly she heard tinkle, 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 and her heart leapt. It was Johnny's bicycle bell. Dear Johnny. She cried, Johnny, I'm over here. And suddenly his hot breath hit her. She said, you've been eating wine gums, haven't you? He said, yes. And his speech was slurred. And he reached forward and his fingers ripped the thin silk from her umbrella.
She said, get away, Johnny. What, Johnny, get away. He said, I want you. I need you, Sarah. And his hot breath was foeted on her mental cheek. And then suddenly, thwonk. The sound of fist against jawbone. There he was, Tarquin Jellyneck, all 7 foot, whatever I said of him, with strong right arm. He had laid low Johnny, who had fallen back unconscious on his bike. Tarquin gathered her to him. His arms went round her twice. She was rather slim. She felt herself borne off towards the wood. An hour later, her heart, her errant heart, was peaceful. She had found her man, and so I thought to herself, was I wrong to think that niceness is all in a man? Surely it's strength that a woman, and I have become a woman, this is the strength that a woman needs. And as if he had read her thoughts, Tarquin said, Goose, he said, ever since I knew you were going out with that Johnny and you thought he was nicer than I am, I've always wanted to put the question to you. And she said, what question? Tantalizingly, the tip of her tongue appearing between her teeth, like the stuffing in an olive. What question, she said. And he said, his mind going back to a railway poster he'd once seen during the war, he said, is your Johnny really nicer, Sarah?
It's no good. I'm still on Johnny's side. We'll go back to Dennis Norton. If you remember, his quotation was, a little touch of Harry in the night.
Surely one of the most eloquent lines in the whole treasure trove of English literature. I was reminded of it recently because I was conducting a campaign against an abuse of the English tongue. Because I found that our language was being abused not just by people who may not know better, but by none other than a government authority, and abused daily several times. It happened when I tried to find out the time on the telephone. Now, in England, if you want to find out the time, you dial TIM on the telephone dial, and there's a click, and a voice says, Isley. At the third stroke, it will be 3 minutes, 10 seconds. And there's a little pause. He says, at the third stroke, it will be 3, 10, and 20 seconds. Now, I want you to think of that phrase, because I listened for an hour to this lady, continually restraining myself from saying thank you. And you noticed that although the time changed every time she spoke, she never once said the same time twice, the phrase didn't. At the third stroke, and then... And I thought to myself, by what right does she call an a stroke? A stroke is a chime, a peal, a doing. Never a would Falstaff have said, we have heard the at midnight? I got so incensed that I wrote immediately to the Postmaster General about this, and 8 weeks later I got a letter back. Dear Mr. Norden, sorry to be so late in replying, but I've only just got your letter. I am a little confused by your complaint. Would you please come and see me? So I went to see him at PMG House. And he said, what can I do for you? I said, your girl on the Tim is saying stroke for an e-. And he moved back. And he said, I think you'd better see my PPS. He's wanting something to do. This is just up his alley. And then I got this letter some 3 weeks later, which cleared the whole matter up. And I'm very glad to say, cleared it up in favour of the authorities. Because the word is correctly used. He explained to me, with his interest in technology, exactly how this effect of the time is achieved. You see, the lady makes that noise herself. She says at the third stroke it will be 3:10 and 10 seconds. And she goes, and it is achieved by having another post office official, one Harry St. John Oggins, who sits beside her, and as she finishes her statement of the time, touches her very lightly with a feather duster. So the use of the word stroke is justified in its other form as a verb, because it does indicate a little touch of Harry on the right.
And in the contest of the two stories, Dennis Norden wins, and his team of Dennis Norden and Anne Scott James win by 1.5 marks only from Dillis Powell and Frank Muir. And this also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC.